Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Anchorage physician educator, Dr. Sergey Boyavlinsky. So why don't you join us and take, as we kind of take a cross-cultural, historical, and maybe even a little evolutionary look at how humans look at disease and healing by looking at the field of medical anthropology. You can reach us with questions and comments. If you're local, that number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our new email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Boyavlinsky, welcome once again to Line One.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Last time we got together, we talked about end-of-life care, and you had introduced me to a book on medical anthropology, and I hate to admit it's taken me a couple of years to get you back on, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, as I said, I wasn't going anywhere.
Let's define medical anthropology for listeners. Let's start there.
Medical anthropology is a branch of anthropology. It is relatively new. I think the formal organization of medical anthropologists as a part of the American Anthropological Association started in the late 60s. And it is a field which deals with disease in human society, with healing, and with epidemiology, and particularly with ideas about disease. Medical anthropology emphasizes the importance of culture as being intertwined with disease. There really is no such thing as a free-floating constellation out there in space which is not affected by human perceptions and human interests. After all, I mean, if a twig cracks out in the forest, and how is that different from somebody's hip cracking? Well, the answer is obvious. There's a huge amount of human attention to such an injury. The second aspect that defines medical anthropology, I would say, is that medical anthropology sees disease and healing as very much a reflection of economics and politics at any given time in history. The main tool of medical anthropology, which is in many ways is what makes it unique, is the tradition in anthropology of ethnography. Ethnography, ethnos, Greek for people, and to write about people. And the original anthropologists started in the they started many thousands of years ago, but as self-defined anthropologists in the 19th century. And these were people who went out mostly to the out into the reaches of the colonial empires of the world and studied native people. They were wonderful ethnographers, wonderful scholars who worked in Alaska, for example, at the end of the 19th century and all over the world. The tradition of ethnography goes on, and it is a kind of skill, kind of, anthropologists are taught how to do it, how to listen to people, and how to let them sort of lead you into the culture. And the final point about medical anthropology is one that medical anthropology does also have practical applications, perhaps only in sorting out how we think about disease and suffering, but most medical anthropologists think that it does have relevance in the world to helping.
You know, when you talk about how culture affects how people think about disease and healing, I want to get back to why you teach the course and you're teaching the course, but I want to get this point. Immediately it came to my mind is the culture of medicine, the culture of science is distinctly different from the culture of the patients. Most patients don't have that same culture. It's like two different cultures interacting. And it seems to me that can cause lots of problems by itself in healing and disease.
It certainly can. I think one of the reasons that our contemporary society is so mistrustful and unhappy with the way things are is that there really is a disconnect between the way formal medicine thinks, the way it reacts to people, and that people have expectations that we do not meet. There's a wonderful story that was collected by Franz Boas, who's sometimes known as the father of American anthropology. He was a German who started by studying Greenland Eskimos and then was a professor at Columbia for half a century. And it's a story of he had a shaman from Vancouver Island in British Columbia kind of jot down his biography, his career. A shaman is a traditional healer. The word shaman is pretty close to doctor. Shamanism is a tradition that goes back 10,000 years and is still viable in the world today. It is mixed with the major religions, Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam. And the idea, what the shaman does is mediates between the spirit world and the sick person. And so this young guy was growing up in the Kwakiutl Nation, and he kind of looked around and he said, well, I know it's all humbug, but, I think it's a pretty good profession to be a shaman. You get paid, there's respect there. And so he apprenticed himself to a shaman and learned all the tricks of how one of the manifestations of healing in that tradition is to suck out a bloody feather from the patient and present that as the cause. And there are other things. An assistant yanks on ropes and things fly around, and the shaman goes into a trance quite often. And so as this young guy's career, he describes it very sincerely, as it developed, he all of a sudden realized that he was indeed very successful in curing people. And he became very famous. And his people then said that the shaman in another village would like to challenge him. And there was a competition, and the other shaman was beaten. He couldn't heal this particular patient of what was ailing her, but our shaman did. And the other shaman asked him to teach him how this was done, and he refused. Does that sound familiar? Mm-hmm. And the net result was that the point I'm trying to make is that he was not a great shaman because he was so good at healing. He was so good at healing because he was considered a great shaman. And he was part of the whole culture's perception of how things worked and what spirits you moved and how you manipulated and pulled people out of suffering.
Mm-hmm. So let's keep going in this direction. And so what is the American culture? I know there's of medicine. I know there's multiple ones. But if I ask you, is there a driving ethos or fact about American culture and how it's looking at medicine today? What how would you respond to that? It seems like we need to understand that if we want to be successful at healing.
We are known around the world as being extremely aggressive. Our medical culture is very, very often falls back on military metaphors. We started with the war on poverty in the 60s, but people are always battling cancer, the war on drugs, and there is an American style which involves going to definitive surgery. We have much higher rates for many, many operations than the European countries, who, after all, have the same scientific knowledge as we do. medicine as it's practiced in the United Kingdom is much more laid back, much more skeptical. The tradition now, which is so much in fashion of evidence-based medicine, is British in its origin. French medicine, for example, is the key thing there is everything's all ailments sort of stem from problems with your liver. And so that if you go to a French doctor and you tell them that you've got bad headaches, well, you have problems with your liver. And that goes on today. The Germans have a diagnosis which no one else shares, which is low blood pressure. And the rest of the Western world feels that, well, yes, low blood pressure can be bad in certain acute situations, but generally it's of no harm at all. But the Germans have all kinds of tonics and things to treat this. So even with an underpinning of Western science, we have pretty big differences.
All right. Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest is Dr. Sergey Boyevlinsky. And we're talking about medical anthropology, the interaction between culture or how culture and society is interacting with health and disease. If you've got questions or comments, we're going to be here for about the next hour. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, for those who listen a lot to us, it's different now. It's line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, let's talk just briefly before we get back to this about your medical teaching. How'd you get interested in medical anthropology? You're teaching a course at UAA. You tell me, how's that going? Who takes those courses and so forth?
Well, I started as an anthropologist, and I did very traditional ethnographic field work in the Bering Strait region of Alaska. I've also worked in Chukotka, which is on the other side of Bering Strait. I did field work among a group of northern Athabascans called the Doneza in northern British Columbia. And after that, I became a doctor. I kept teaching anthropology here and there, and I've always thought of myself as an anthropologist. One of my big interests was linguistics. And then I became a doctor. And as the years of doctoring progressed, I realized that I was starting to look at things more and more through the eyes of an anthropologist. It was always very interesting to see, to look at the ideology of biomedicine and patients' perceptions and the whole mystery of the healing process, which is healers are universal. There is no culture that doesn't practice that.
And you teach a course at UAA?
I do teach a course at UAA called Medical Anthropology. It's there is a beginning medical anthropology, and then there's intermediate, and they overlap. And the purpose of the course, in a way, is to answer my questions about medicine, modern medicine. And that is that we're all confronted by this barrage daily of the, to paraphrase Eisenhower, instead of the military-industrial complex, the medical-industrial complex. And there is no other discipline, perhaps some sociologists who ask, how do we evaluate this? What about these enormous institutions that spend all of this money? How should we look at them? What about SARS, for example? What about the influenza vaccine? What is the relationship of what doctors do to science? Whom do we trust, and how do we begin to look at it? And the traditional tools of anthropology are quite useful here. Anthropology, one of the successes of ethnographic fieldwork, has been to evaluate and systematize systems of belief, ways of thinking. And if you look at modern medicine from that point of view, what emerges is a kind of ideology which is underpins much of what we doctors do, but of which we are largely unaware.
Okay. We already have a caller. I want to take this gentleman. He's calling from Alexander Creek and has some questions. Don, welcome to Line 1. What can we do for you?
Hello, Todd. This is Don Couillard. I lived at Alexander Creek by the Sleeping Lady for the last 30, 35 years. And when I went over there to cut my trees in 1975 in the month of February for 13 days, I cut down 48 trees. But when I'd cut two or three trees down, I had to shut the chainsaw off and sit down and rest. And when I did that, I could hear this hum that was very similar to a hum I used to hear as a young boy walking under the high power lines, of a relatively low frequency and a constant a power source. But then when I built my log cabin and moved into the cabin, the hum was much more profound in the cabin. And it took me 10 years before figuring it out what it was and what it was, where it was coming from and what it was doing. But being an aviator all my life, working with the electromagnetic field, I was very well accustomed to thunderstorms and magnetic compass operations and everything, and then also studying biology for 6 years, looking at the process of mitosis, I found that it's electrical power that governs the process of mitosis in every living cell on this planet Earth. And it seems to be generated in two sources. One is from the magnetic dynamo in the center of the Earth, and the other is when the organism is born and it's got feathers or like birds or hair on animals or leaves on a tree, where it gets the majority of the electricity for the rest of its life is from the sun, just as the Egyptians told us many years ago. Now I've got this all out to other universities and on a DVD and everything, and nobody wants to accept it. It's not your man on anthropology, except that it's electrical force that governs process of life on this planet Earth?
Well, I think that many, many people would be interested in your theory. And if you want, I'm sure that Dr. Woodard would love to hear, to listen to your disc.
Yeah, Don, I think it sounds to me like you want to promote your understanding of why a lot of illness exists. And this is probably not the right forum for that. I would think that you need to do that in other forums. I'm not so sure that I would necessarily agree with your hypothesis, and I'm not sure that the evidence leads there. But I don't think this is the particular forum for our discussion of that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I listen to your program every week, and I just thought there's some force that governs life, and it's sure electrical, in my opinion. And I found out that its source and it operates in two stages. The basic comes from the magnetic dynamo that keeps your Earth a charge capacitor, and the majority comes from the sun. The same, and it's so easy to understand if these scientists would open up their mind and listen to it, but... I'm having quite a difficult time convincing people to even listen.
Well, I'd keep it up and go out of your way to make sure you give us some good evidence. That's what makes a difference, is the quality of the evidence that you present. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, too.
I hope I didn't detain you.
No, we enjoyed you for calling, and thanks for doing that. You have a good day. Sergey, give us some more examples of how culture interacts with disease, and or maybe even the socioeconomic aspects that you brought up. I think that's also a critical component of ourselves dealing with healthcare today in the United States.
Well, we are becoming more and more aware of the fact that there's a greater and greater differences in income. That the gap between those who that gap between the poor and the rich is increasing in this country, and the incidence of various chronic illnesses in particular is much higher among people of lower income. And so this is a very clear-cut association. The life expectancy of somebody who has an income below poverty and is not educated is significantly lower than that of the upper end in income.
Mm-hmm.
For example, that's one. If we look at close to home, Alaska Native statistics, for the past 10 years, Alaska Native life expectancy has been significantly lower than that of non-natives in the state. The neonatal death rate, in other words, babies die in and around birth, is about the same as that of the non-native population, but the death rate in the first year of life is double. And these are clearly reflections of economic and perhaps political factors.
That's been looked at increasingly. It seems like it's not necessarily socially acceptable in all parts of our culture. I mean, there is our culture is separated in the sense that there are those who either don't believe that kind of evidence or refuse to accept that. And it seems like it gets back to cultural understanding of responsibility, for example, in some situations.
Yes, that certainly is the thinking of many groups in this country. It's an interesting historical point, but discussion of social class, even in the context of epidemiology, had been a taboo subject in the United States, particularly during the Cold War. We did not have class. It sounded like communist propaganda to discuss that. And so that for many years, people in Europe were amazed that American health statistics did not include that variable. I think we've gotten away from that. But the study of disease in this country by epidemiologists are people who track diseases in populations. Traditionally, epidemiologists studied infectious disease. Since infectious diseases have decreased significantly, epidemiologists have gone after non-infectious diseases. Computer, which became practical in, let's say, probably in already in the 1960s, certainly in the 70s, made it possible to analyze huge numbers of data, running every 20 variables against 20 other variables, and so the epidemiologist kind of went off in that direction. The variables that were studied were sort of very close to clinical medicine. There's not a tradition of looking at things from a socioeconomic point of view.
And you brought up, to expand on that idea, that when you're class, that you often have students go out and talk to individuals who may have some chronic disease to help them help the students understand the patient's conception of why they might be ill. And you commented on that before the program. Maybe that's an example of what you're talking about.
It certainly is. In this course, I asked these students to find somebody with a chronic disease who is willing to talk about themselves, to give a disease narrative, as Dr. Kleinman, who's head of medical anthropology at Harvard, calls it. And as part of educating these students to be good anthropologists, I emphasize to them that when one does anthropological field work, you also have to respect confidentiality and so on, as we do in medicine. And the students at first kind of were shy about doing this, but everybody just about finds it extremely meaningful. People are very eager and interested in talking about their diseases. And here, to go back to your question about culture and disease, you take one person with, let's say, for some reason, the multiple sclerosis pops into my head, which, by the way, is supposedly more common in northern countries. Mm-hmm. And the students did find quite a few of such people. And so what they get a sense of is, besides the suffering and the meaning of the disease for the person, but also how it affects his or her whole life, family, and so on. And people have almost invariably an explanation of the disease. They will tell you what they fear the most about it, why they came down with it, and what they think will happen. Interestingly enough, an explanation that comes up time and again is that these patients volunteer that they think that that the fact of moving to Alaska is what precipitated their disease. Mm-hmm. It's very, very educational to see that the disease has a human face always. That is not just a pathogen, bacteria, and here's what's damaged.
Well, one of the problems with multiple sclerosis or many chronic diseases is we often can't tell people why they have this problem. And is it evolutionarily, culturally entwined that we want to understand? And so we make up or we fit what seems to be a reasonable explanation, even if, from a purely scientific standpoint, it doesn't necessarily make sense.
I completely agree with you. I think there's a wonderful paper by an author whom I've forgotten, but it's classic. It's called the Epidemiology or Facing the Menace of Daily Life. And everybody will recognize this. Some group somewhere gets funded to study, let's say, the effect of cabbage on cancer. And they'll come up with some correlations, and then the newspapers will get a hold of it, and there will be, don't eat cabbage, it causes cancer. And we have one study after another like this. A very fashionable, now for many years, is to say that such and such a disease has a multifactorial cause. In other words, there are many causes. And then we identify risk factors. It goes back to the famous Framingham Heart Study that started in the late 50s. And so certain diseases, the list of risk factors for coronary disease, heart disease, has reached over 300 now. And the conclusion that you have to draw from this is that this is basically circular thinking, and that if we say that the causes of this disease are multifactorial, we're saying we do not know what the cause of this disease is. Right. But yet we now have this tremendous need to explain things. And in many ways, the whole idea of preventive medicine and treating risk factors, for example, has not panned out. There have been some very, very rigorous interventions into large populations to prevent or to diminish coronary disease. In 1977, I worked for a year in Finland at a university hospital in Kuopio. I originally grew up in Finland. And at the time, next door to us was the province of North Karelia. And North Karelia had the unfortunate, it was famous for the fact that it had the highest death rate from coronary disease in the world at the time. Their population was 180,000, 1,000 deaths from myocardial infarction, from heart attacks a year. And so the Finnish government then decided that they were going to intervene, and they took cholesterol, they started to propaganda about diet, increased taxes on cigarettes sky high. Every person in North Karelia had to have their blood pressure measured every 6 months and then were treated if it were high. Exercise was promoted. There were practically big signs on milk bottles and butter containers with the skull and crossbones on them. And so this noble effort, which I knew the guys that were doing this, and they really believed in it, and they were honest. This was not financed by any pharmaceutical company. And what happened was that in about 7 years, indeed, the coronary disease rate went down in North Karelia. And everybody felt very happy about that. And then what happened was that somebody looked at the data and so on again. And what had happened was that a coronary disease rate in all the other provinces in Finland was quite high. North Karelia was merely the highest. And during those 7 years, the coronary disease rate dropped all over Finland. North Karelia was just the last. And so after all of this was said and done and these risk factors treated, the conclusion was that the intervention had nothing to do with mm-hmm. And this kind of study has been repeated four or five times on a very large scale. And in every case, unfortunately, what it comes up with is that we just don't know what the cause of this, right, of coronary disease is.
Yeah. And it's not an unusual story for medicine that we think we have an understanding and or some very attractive person promotes a very significant, seems like great answer. I don't want to get in trouble with the surgeons, but it's often a surgical fix for something that goes on for a while, and then suddenly some good science shows that it's not true.
Well, let me mention to you, now that you mentioned surgery, and I've been a surgeon, and I've been quite interested in the culture of surgeons and how surgeons think. There's been a pretty good ethnography of surgeons called The Scalpel's Edge by Pearl Katz. What I wanted to mention was there's Dr. John Wenberg, Jack Wenberg, who's currently at the Maine Medical Center. Back in the 1970s, Dr. Wenberg was doing work for the state of Vermont on rates of surgical procedures. And he found out that, let's say, Rat River, Vermont had a tonsillectomy rate of 10 per 1,000 per year. And then East Rat River had a rate of 100 per 1,000 per year. And, I mean, these are just exaggerations. And Dr. Wenberg then went through the whole process of figuring out why. Was it that the population was very different in how sick it was? And this, by the way, applied not just to tonsillectomy, it applied to hysterectomies and so on. And what he figured out was, in very, very convincingly, that these variations in surgical rates did not reflected what doctors, what the local doctor culture dictated, and also was dictated by the number of hospital beds available. Dr. Wenberg has since then summarized his life's work, and what I wanted to share with you is that he has decided that approximately 15% of surgical procedures are proven, life-saving, and should be done. If you have a bleeding gastric ulcer, somebody's got to throw a few stitches into it, and so on. A broken hip is no question about it. And the incidence of broken hips in the population is steady. In other words, hip operations are not something that you can sell to the public. Then Dr. Wenberg says that approximately another 40% of operations done in this country are discretionary. And the bottom line is that these are operations that, yeah, they sometimes work, they sometimes don't work, but it is the doctors who do the sales job. They teach people. They tell people, a patient goes to the doctor and he comes out and says, well, the doctor thinks I need to have such and such an operation. Well, the doctor knows what he or she's doing, so they acquiesce. And then you can do the arithmetic subtraction yourselves. If Winberg feels that 15% are proven solid, 40% are discretionary, so that adds up to 55. So 45% of surgical operations are under serious doubt. And the discretionary ones, interestingly enough, it works this way. The Ontario government made a study of, I think they were studying knee, potential patients who needed knee, who might need knee operations. And they found that using the criteria that are sort of standard surgical indications, they found that far more people could be candidates for knee surgery than actually were getting. And of course, this shocked the Ontario government because they would have to pay for it. But what it turns out was that a lot of people did qualify for knee operations, but a huge number of them just didn't want to do it because they understood what it entailed and that it didn't necessarily work.
Fascinating stuff, and it reminds me of a book I've mentioned before called Caring for Patients, which looks at the reasons why people come to non-surgeons for health care and how that breaks down into real disease versus psychosocial disease. But we won't go there. We need to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is lineone@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take calls and emails and talk with Anchorage physician and educator, Dr. Sergey Bodyev-Linsky. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line One, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line One, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection, and I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Sergey Bodyev-Linsky. He teaches medical anthropology at UAA, and we're talking about cultural aspects of disease and healing. You can email questions to lineone@alaskapublic.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433, our local number 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to the program between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded broadcast. We won't be able to take your questions or call or comments, so please do that in the next 15 to 20 minutes if you intend to do so. Here's an email we've got, and here's the way I'd like you to think about this, Sergey. Let's answer this lady's email, thinking of it as a medical anthropologist, if you don't mind. The title of the email is Naturopathic Medicine versus Traditional Medicine. She writes, I believe that there will be an increasing fear in treatment of illness. We don't know what our prescription drug treatment for illnesses will ultimately do to us. They might result in an additional illness. Just listen to all of the side effects listed in any commercial. What damage is done to organs when we are all on all of these pharmaceuticals? Are the pharmaceutical companies or FDA really interested in our overall treatment? Next paragraph, naturopathic medicine is somewhat scary too. I prefer it, but my GP does not. My naturopath says no mammography annually due to increased exposure to radiation and tissue damage due to compression. My GP cuts me an order to get one immediately. It's scary.
I think your situation is very typical for thoughtful people. The question of drugs and harm. One of my People who know me know that one of the things that I often will say is, I'll look at somebody and say, gosh, so you're another person that thinks that there's a pill for everything in the world. And indeed, this is what our pharmaceutical companies, which in many ways, of course, are a very great service to the world. But they also are out after the, you know, marketing and the bottom line. And there is a very, very strong tendency to push drugs beyond what they're intended to do, where into areas where the risks really do become significant. The story of drugs in this country is interesting in that in several cases that I can think of, very prominent cases, first the drug is invented, and then the indications, the use of it is expanded partly by the marketing departments of the pharmaceutical companies. For example, the category of thiazides, which is a diuretic, the original one was Diaryl. The company that sold it was instrumental in changing the therapeutic strategies of American doctors by including more and more people into the category of people whose blood pressure was posing them a threat. You're right. My personal way of looking at drugs, and this is in my clinical practice, is that I usually don't start prescribing a drug until it's out for 10 years, but because by that time all the aftermarket side effects will be known. Mammography debate is fascinating. As you probably know, about a year ago, the Federal Commission on Preventive Medicine stated that no mammography was no longer necessary for women between 40 and 50, that is routine screening mammography, and that routine screening mammography for older women could be done every other year. There was a hue and a cry, basically because of pure misunderstanding of statistics and how these things work. And overall, I think the evidence is now coming out, and there's been this point of view on mammography for many, many years, that its benefits are highly exaggerated. And one way of looking at it is that it's a biological fact that we're all going to die. And a person who lives to 70 years and 10, 70, and is in good health is actually very fortunate. Anything over 80, you're doing well. But by 80, you will have accumulated at least half a dozen of potentially lethal diseases. And so that the screening for breast cancer, for example, I would also even argue screening colonoscopy, does not ultimately affect longevity in populations. There are 3 million people that die a year in the United States or more, and of these, 50,000 die of colon cancer, which is a slow-growing disease, and so on. In any case, your concerns are very, very real, and I think that medical anthropology at least would try to put things into context and say, who's profiting by this? Why do they do this? What good is it for whom? And that's a very good point of view to take.
Let me look at her question a little bit differently. What does it tell us, medical anthropology or culturally, that we have a large need for alternative medical approaches in this time of dramatic developments in some serious diseases, such as cancer, when we don't have alternative engineering, alternative chemistry, alternative physics in a time when we have equally exciting new understandings?
Well, for one, I think the part of the answer is that given the fact that we have become a very secular culture, and that people have become very centered on, have been on consumption, and material goods and so on, that the prolongation of an individual life has almost become paramount. It's become the focus. We no longer think about what, how life will be for our grandchildren or for other people around the world. It's this focus on life itself, so to speak. And doctors are biomedical doctors are just are probably the root cause of all this enthusiasm for alternative medicine, because if you listen to, if you go into the office of a typical American doctor, they will the doctor will tell you that if you follow what she tells you to do, you take these pills, you'd stop smoking, you go and exercise, then I kind of can guarantee you eternal life almost. And then the doctors will turn right around and say, well, but of course, you know, this is all statistics. And you personally, I can't guarantee it, but overall, yes, it's going to be a big help. And those claims, of course, are very, very are transparently shaky. But we've sort of raised the appetite of the public to think in this way, to expect great things. And then the epidemiologists come out with their lists of risk factors and so on. And so then all of a sudden people start moving through this minefield of things to avoid or things to eat, for example.
Okay. All right. I'd kind of remind Mary as well is that when you get information like this, each person's risks and benefits of different treatments make a difference. As Dr. Bojevlinski has mentioned, in younger people, maybe the risk of complications, problems of false diagnosis of mammography is different than someone who is 50 or 60, and that's different than someone who is 80. And also this comment that she made that the mammography increases exposure to radiation is true, but the evidence, I think, suggests that there's very little evidence that that's causing any significant harm. So I just ask her to look at the different amounts of evidence, get as much information as you can, and individualize your treatment. It usually makes a lot of sense. We have another caller that has an interesting question, it appears. It seems to be related to your comments on surgery, Dr. Bojevlinski. So let's see what Robin has to say. Robin, what can we do for you?
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my...
You still there? All right. Robin, it sounds like maybe you accidentally disconnected yourself, so please try to come back if you will. It looks like to me from Kristen's comments on her call is it had to do with the number of people who actually get recommended to have surgery and the number who actually go and have surgeries. It seemed like there was some question about that. Are you, maybe she's getting at the point that, you know, a lot of people do have recommendations for surgery, but people put it off already for various reasons.
You know, I would say that before anybody has any elective surgery, they should do some research about it. And surgery is very difficult to assess.
What about cultural aspects of the new technologies that are available? You're a gynecologist, and you've done some obstetrics, I think, and you have some comments perhaps about technology and birth that might be worth discussing as well.
Yeah, it's obstetrics is a good example of technology almost taking over for the sake of technology. Back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, the statistics for maternal health and problems with pregnancies had kind of leveled off. The big advances had come with blood banks, antibiotics, and trained, skilled people to take care of pregnancies. And the C-section rate was 5% in this country. The situation with births was at least in the Northeast, was that the modern new way, the contemporary safe way to have a baby was to go into labor, be knocked out during labor with Demerol and scopolamine, and then when you were ready to deliver, you got a spinal anesthetic whether you needed it or not, and the doctor pulled out the baby with forceps. And forceps, of course, are a wonderful invention, saved many lives, particularly when people had tuberculosis of the bone and had narrow hips, etc. And the use of forceps in the 1960s in the northeast of this country was basically a perversion of this. This was kind of technology taking over where there was no need for it. Now, the 1960s also was the start of the coronary care unit. And so obstetricians decided that they too needed something that corresponded to monitoring, cardiac monitoring. And so the intrapartum fetal monitoring, in other words, the baby's heartbeat is recorded and printed on a strip, just like a cardiogram, and the mother's contractions are plotted parallel to it. And Medtronic was a big company in those days, and still is, and Medtronic went out and sold this stuff to the point where it was accepted by the mid-70s in this country wholesale without ever having been rigorously tested. And interestingly enough, and fetal monitoring still continues. In 1990, the CDC in Atlanta issued two papers saying that after careful study, they did not recommend that fetal monitoring be used to make any important decisions in managing birth. And it was very interesting to see how there was no impact whatsoever on the practice of obstetrics. And so that technology had now... obstetricians, both in the Western Europe and here, had painted themselves into a corner where this was the standard of care, so-called, and there was no way of answering the question is, what if the standard of care, and this doesn't apply just to obstetrics, is bad medicine? And so now we're completely, if you walk into a labor room at an American hospital or in Western Europe, you will see no one is looking at the patient who's in labor. They're all looking at the electronic monitor.
We've got about 5 minutes left, and I was wondering if the whole echoing of your thoughts about the industrialization, the complexity, the increased technology of healthcare in the last 20 or 30 years has had a large part to play in alienating a large section of the public to from the feeling that they have control, that they can understand what's going on to them, and it may have driven them to look for alternative ways to understand their health problem.
I certainly agree with you that with increased technology, increased specialization, the patient's constant complaint is that nobody listens to them. You know, what does your family doctor do? My family doctor sends me to different specialists,
right.
And then I never can get a grip on what they're planning for me. I do think that is the case. Nevertheless, of course, technology is wonderful, and we've seen even in the last 20 years, big advances in because of technology. However, there's also the bad side of technology is that technology generates more technology. We find out things, we diagnose things that we really don't even need to know about, and then the cascade goes on and on and on. And people are lost in this. They feel that they are just a cog.
Okay. Let's try to take one quick call. We've only got a couple of minutes. Sarah, you're on line one.
Thank you.
Got about a minute or two, real quick,
okay.
For us.
My general question is, I'm a healthcare worker as well, and I've observed this in everyday occurrences, but then I recently read a book by a doctor about this, and I wanted to know your opinion on, it seems like the clients out there, the patients out there that have very complicated, multiple chronic illnesses, which hard to pinpoint what is the actual problem, that those are the clients that oftentimes get some of the poorest medical care. And I just wanted to know, and also get stereotypes applied to them, like they're pain seekers or malingerers or whatever. I just wanted to know if you could, I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call, Sarah.
Thank you.
I think there are many, many different ways of looking at this, but I think the sicker people are often also the poorest people and the oldest people, and that is and a vast number of doctors are really not interested in taking and sorting things like this out. It's very difficult to begin with, and doctors like to be successful and to have easier lives. I do agree with you that we underserve the sickest. We're very bad, really, at taking care of chronically ill people with many, many diseases going on at the same time.
And certainly physicians are frustrated when they can't put an answer on it. And it's, I guess, human nature to think, it must be the patient's problems. And I think that's a terrible idea to give back to patients. And we need to be better at helping be more empathetic to these things we don't understand.
We certainly should, yes, mm-hmm. I agree.
All right. Well, we're coming close to the end of another hour. We've got just about a minute. Let me ask you to just summarize your thoughts about what you want people to come away from in this next last minute about medical anthropology.
I think that medical anthropology is creeping into public discourse more and more without even being identified as such. But and I think that's a very good deal. I think the questions raised on this program during this last hour are very germane. The whole issue of why is alternative medicine so popular, I think every doctor should look into themselves and say, what am I missing?
Seems to me we just constantly have to have a better communication skill, a better dialogue, a better understanding of what science can and can't do for us, and we'd all be better off for it. Thanks very much for taking the time with us today. My thanks to our guest, Dr. Sergey Bogos-Yavlinsky. Why don't you join us in the next 2 weeks on Monday afternoon? I'll be gone next week. It'll be July 4th. We won't have a program. So our next program will be July 11th at 2 p.m. When we'll have the next edition of Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest at that time will be Anchorage social worker Richard Steinzig. And we'll be discussing that most difficult age of life that we all deal with, adolescence. He'll give us some hints on how to handle that age as parents and adults. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Smack engineered today's program and manned the phones for us. Thanks for listening, and especially to those of you who took the time to call and email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great afternoon.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.